Hey, Truck Roy here. We're on the Riding Shotgun Show, and I got Bob Whitaker back. This is the second time I've had him on my show. The first time was a couple years ago when I was first starting out, and my way of thinking has progressed a great deal since then, but Bob's hasn't because he's kind of been on the same track for a long time, and I'm moving closer to where he's at, and he's just talking. We're talking about why communism doesn't work.
Well, again, we're also talking about how simple some of this stuff is.
Right.
I almost never bring in new information.
Like fresh off the presses stuff?
Yeah. For example, when I talk to communists, which I've done an awful lot, I say, well, what are you going to produce?
And the communists respond.
That's what you did. Yeah, he says, I'm going to produce food and, you know, I mean, when I finally get, he thinks the question is incredible to start with. But there's one fellow I did. My second book was called The New Right Papers. It was an anthology from leaders of the New Right that had just left Reagan.
That just left what?
Elected Ronald Reagan.
Okay, okay.
And this was in 1982, and it was a big thing. We'd made this coalition, working class and the Republican conservatives. They used to call us the Wallace conservatives, and then they became very respectful after 1980. Called them the Reagan Democrats.
Right. I've heard
called them the Wallace Democrats before that. But all of a sudden, when they came to dominate, you know, they suddenly became something else. But with communism, one fellow writing in the New York papers pointed out that when he was in Russia, he happened to run into this warehouse. I don't know how he was able to wander around as much as he did, but he happened to this warehouse that was full of hula hoops.
Oh, really?
This is not a joke. It's full of hula hoops.
In Russia?
Yeah. Because what do you produce in a communist country?
Well, they were starving and stuff over there. I think they'd be producing wheat.
Yeah, they don't produce wheat. But, I mean, the practical problem is, too. What I'm saying is, basically, first, what do you produce? Why did they produce these hula hoops, which didn't sell, by the way? They had a huge place of hula hoops because the communists always assumed they would have market economies and they would produce whatever they produced, right?
Right.
Otherwise, you're just going to produce the same thing forever.
Yeah, it's stagnant. There's no innovation.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's so basic. That's too basic for most people. They want to talk about the theories, the labor theory of value, or this theory, or, you know, Einstein's theory, or so forth. But basically, you know, I start with, well, what are you going to produce?
Right.
This is the way I think. People don't think about, like, for instance, you can't have a border. A border is discrimination.
Right.
That's what it's for.
Yeah.
When you make a phone call, when a policeman calls and somebody says, saw a man running away from here, how tall was he? Well, he was the height of several hundred thousand other Americans. And, well, what race was he? Well, I don't want you chasing down on every man of his color in the city. Now, how long do you think it would take before the buggy boys came and got that policeman?
Yeah.
You cannot. You can't catch anybody. You have to say if it's a male or a female.
That would make a great skit. Have a cop calling in from his police car. And they're, this is dispatch. What does the suspect look like? Well, I don't want to get too racial here, you know.
The first thing you say is, what height is he?
Yeah,
well, he is the height of several hundred thousand other American citizens.
I'll tell you a story, Bob. I used to live out in Southern California. And back out there when my grandpa was a kid, he used to, he wanted to get into the police, I think. And they had a rule that you had to be so tall. You had to be, you know, a certain fitness to make it, to be a police officer. To be considered for the job, you had to be like at least 5'10", I think, or 6 foot. And since then, that's been eliminated because it was discriminatory. And so now we have all these short little cops out there. And, I mean, you don't want to tangle with these guys because they're not going to wrestle with you. They'll just shoot you.
Well, that brings up a lot. I think that's one of the problems is that brings up a lot of interesting things in my mind. It would be more interesting to the audience, probably, than what I'm thinking about, than what I'm trying to get across. And that's the problem with interviews.
You run off course?
Well, off of my course.
Right.
That's not the course.
Well,
but you are basically in entertainment here.
Well, yeah.
And I only have so much to say.
Well, we got to stretch it out, so I'll run people off course a little bit and you bring it back.
All right, well, let's go back to this thing about the, you're talking about he'll shoot him first. I noticed these days they're actually, some of these shows, I watch them all, the actuality shows.
Yeah.
But it used to be, I remember distinctly, when broadcasting was a monopoly, that they never had anybody resisting.
Okay.
They said, you know, give him your wallet, fall down, you know, give him, you know, ask if he wants to rape your daughter, get your voice high, say please, please, you know, on and on and on about no resistance.
Right.
I don't know if that's before your time, but now they're showing people resisting, and even with firearms, which used to be absolutely, I mean, they would always, they never showed anybody using the firearms right.
Right.
Yeah. But.
Well, you know, see, I don't remember that so much, that era. But I do clearly remember the era when on the airplanes, when you fly on the airplanes, or whenever they talk about hijackings or anything, they'd always say, don't resist, you know, because it just
right.
You know, let the authorities take care of it. Well, I think after 9/11, that's kind of out the window.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's just slowly begun to get. See, for me, this is a breakthrough. See, you don't know the totalitarianism I lived under.
Right.
I'm not saying it was worse or better. I'm saying it was different. I mean, when I was coming up, if you said anything good about guns, anything, or that anybody should have a gun, it was absolutely blanked out.
Yeah.
It was, so this racial thing is not new, but see, I can see things moving that you can't.
What? And it seems to me that things are moving since the 60s in a positive direction. I mean, the 60s is kind of the height of stupidity, wasn't it?
Yeah, and also, it's like I say, people can finally go down from having academic Marxist intellectuals sitting around talking about the process of revolutionary and the class thing through history, and then they have somebody saying, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you try, leftism has been tried, I don't know how many times, and I mean, after trying it so many times, and it ends up with tens of millions of people getting killed over here, tens of millions of people starving to death in Ukraine or whatever, I think there's a certain point. Well, and the thing is, you got to remind them about it. This is a point you make. You can't just...
Yeah, the point I make is that they talk. You talk about the direction of history, but you talk about the direction of history that you see.
Right.
And when something like this happens, when I can't believe they're saying this about guns, I say it to you, and you all go on to something important. So, but if it's on civil rights and they say, Martin Luther King, you know, managed to abolish this and this, and that was a great trial, those are the only crimes you're going to hear about.
Right.
When I talk about this gun business, I mean, that's incredible. It used to be, and that was the one thing that no respectable person ever said. Even the respectable conservatives had to learn that. They'd get on their shows when they started off. They'd always be able to against guns. I've never owned a gun. I don't know nobody that owns a gun and all that stuff. And they'd get their people all over them. You know?
Right.
They had to learn from the back, from the beginning, what Americans are like.
Well, you know, I don't think that Americans really just started, changing their opinions. I think they bumped up against reality.
That's all I do.
Yeah.
See, I talk about. And behind, it's amazing to me. It's like this, you were talking about the mantra. You got to tell your crowd what, your evolution on the mantra.
Oh, well, you know, the mantra, and I'm going to butcher it here, but let me tell you guys what the mantra is for you who haven't heard of it. But the mantra is just kind of some talking points that Bob Whitaker come up with, and he's really good at what he does, so it's worth investigating. But the mantra goes like this. It says, you know, Africa for the Africans, Asia for the Asians, white nations for everyone. They say that there's a race problem, and that this race problem only exists in white countries, and the solution to it is to flood white nations and only white nations with hundreds of millions of non-whites. What if I told an African?
Yeah, just sound only.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so what if I told an African guy over in Africa? If I said to him, "I want to flood your nation or your continent with hundreds of millions of non-Africans to create a blended humanity just in Africa," you know, he would realize that you're trying to genocide him. So, and when they say that they're anti-racist, that doesn't apply to, you know, it only applies to white folks. So anti-racism is a code word for anti-white.
Yeah, it's
And what they're advocating is genocide.
Well, the reason that the first time you heard it, tell them what you meant.
Okay,
about.
Well, I Bob used to post on Stormfront a lot, and he'd post from his blog, which is Bob's Underground Seminars, and what's the website for that, Bob? BobWhitaker.com or something like that? Here, I got it on my computer. I'll pull it up and I'll tell folks in there.
It's WhitakerOnline.org/blog.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, so he'd post over on Stormfront. I kept seeing his posts, and he'd always have his mantra in there, what I just told you, essentially. And he has it worded just perfect, and a person should learn it. But I would read it, and I just wouldn't get it. I mean, it was simple. Obviously, when I say Asia for the Asians, Africa for the Africans, it's like, no kidding. That's like saying, you know, gravity is real or something like that. Everybody knows that. Africa for the Africans, Asia for the Asians. And I'd read it, and I go, look, I know Bob Whitaker's a smart guy. He's trying to tell me something here.
The last part is white countries for everybody.
Right. Africa for the Africans, Asia for the Asians, white countries for everyone. And we just take that as reality. I mean, the stupidity of it doesn't even strike us. You know, I mean, I've read this thing for 2 freaking years, and it never clicked in my head. I mean, finally it started to click in my head, but it was an itch in the back of my head. I kept reading it. I'm going, what the hell is he trying to tell me here? And, you know, it's not, you know, what it is just kind of changing your perspective.
See, yeah, it's looking up, yeah.
There's so many people out there, probably a lot of people listening to this right now, who think, I'm racial. They might even think, I'm racist. And yet, their perspective is still that they're being bad, or they're being rebellious, or they don't realize that we have the moral high ground. Even if they say that they think we have the moral high ground, they don't really believe it. And once you start reading Bob Whitaker's stuff and just comprehending, you know, some of these things. I mean, this is genocide that we're fighting against. It's not that we're worried about high crime or anything else. We're in the process of being, you know, if I told an African that I was flooding this nation with hundreds of millions of Africans, non-Africans, people from China and Brazil and everywhere else in the world to create a blended humanity just in his part of the world, nowhere else he would know that I'm genociding him.
Yeah, I was just thinking what you said about when I said about the profiling and then make a joke of it with the cop saying, how tall was he? Well, he was the height of several hundred thousand other American citizens.
Right.
And you say, what race was he? He was the race of several million American citizens.
Right.
And you can't profile the entire population that's of this particular height or this particular color, you know.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody would come and take him to the booby hatch. But before they do, you know, you said, well, this would make a great anti-profiling, you know, some anti-profiling advertisement.
Yeah, it would make a hell of a skit.
Have somebody actually do that.
Yeah. that would be good. Now, I've kind of listened to some of your stuff and read some of your stuff, and there's one point that really has hit home with me, and I've mentioned it on Derek Black's program, and you know, a lot of your stuff is takes me a minute to get. Some of it's kind of funny, but there's one thing that really hit home with me and it struck a chord in me, and that was when you mentioned the fact that when they say undocumented worker or undocumented American, really that reduces an American to being what papers you have.
Yeah, which happens to be true, but today. But that is about the lowest thing you can say. As in other words, I thought about a bumper sticker that says, "I'm not American, I'm documented."
Right, right. Well, but see, you know, that's really kind of scary for me because I know you were alive when the Cold War was really rocking and rolling. And
right in the middle of it, yes.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that was always the joke because the Cold War fell when I was like 12 or something, but I can remember people joking around, you know, doing a Russian accent and say, "Papers, please," you know, talking about, you know, these dictatorships where you have to show your papers. And if you can't recognize your countryman by what he looks like,
then you got to have papers. And the papers are decided by the bureaucrats.
Yeah, and but see, the implications of this are that the entire population of the world are Americans just waiting for their papers.
Well, we are a nation of immigrants. Have you heard that?
Yeah, you know.
But you heard that, but you never laughed at it.
Right.
I remember in class one time, the professor, I was in college, and the professor, that's in, I think, my third book about the professor, he read the preamble to the Soviet Constitution, and it said, "We are a nation of workers, farmers, soldiers, so forth, and intellectuals." And I giggled when he said that. And the reason I giggled was something that would be impossible for a college student today to understand, it was for them too, is let's say you and me, or you and me and a couple of guys are setting up a little group here, and I say, "Okay, you be the soldier, you be the farmer, you be the factory worker, I'll sit here and tell you what to do.
I'll be the intellectual."
No 10-year-old would follow.
Yeah,
and I think I just spent too much time thinking logically. Let some damn fool tell me he was going to be the intellectual.
Well, yeah. And this is the problem: is that we just take ideas seriously that aren't serious.
We don't think about it. Yeah. Well, I was thinking too about your that thing, those things I was putting together a while ago about your let's see,
skip.
The profiling skit.
Yeah.
And there's another one, my poor old mind. We were talking about something else. Oh, yeah. What if you went on a black program and the interviewing, you know, interviewer sounds black, and you say, "Well, I believe that we need to have open borders in all of sub-Saharan Africa, Jamaica," you know, and you name them one by one.
Haiti.
You know, yeah, Haiti, and so forth. And I think that that's would show how moral black people are.
Right.
And he said, "Whoa."
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to make it up from there, but, I mean, nobody would fall for that crap.
Yeah.
If you selected each country, it's like right now. They're talking about, is Eastern Europe ready for immigration? Now, they don't ask they don't ask any other country.
Yeah, well, you know.
In other words, did they ask about Eastern Europe?
I'd like to see a couple commentators.
Because they're white.
Right,
they're
right.
Supposed to have friction.
Yeah, no two commentators sit down and with real serious faces say, "Is Tibet ready for immigration right now?" Mm-hmm. Or, "Is Japan ready for immigration?" Or, "Is it time to flood the Philippines with, you know?"
Yeah, it's racist for them, you know. But the point I'm making is, it was so automatic that people. I was talking to a Bulgarian commentator about this, and I said, "You've heard people ask you if Bulgaria is ready for immigration, right?" And they said, "Yes, but it's not ready for immigration." I said, "No, that's not the point. Again, that's not the point I'm making. Why did they ask about Bulgaria?"
Because it's white?
Because it is white.
Yeah.
And nobody even notices it.
Right. I mean, this is the whole point. Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine recently who's not, he says, well, I'm not really racial. You know how these people say, well, like, I'm proud to be Irish, even though, like, if they went back to Ireland, the people would say they're Americans or whatever. But they're like, I'm proud to be Irish, or I'm proud to be whatever. And this guy's an Anglophile, and he's like, you know, talk about how he's English, and he's like, well, I don't really care about these other immigrants into America. You know, America was an English colony, and this and this and that. And he says, you know, this whole struggle or whatever should not be racial per se. And I said, you know, it's racial because our enemies have made it racial. I mean,
yeah.
I didn't say, hey, I'm going to be, racially conscious about being white. I was made racially conscious when they blamed white people for every bad thing that's happened and decided that we have to be changed.
You know, if we said the same thing about Jews that they say about whites,
oh,
we'd be Hitler.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Flip that around, Bob. Give them an example of that.
Well, like, everything white people do is for greed.
Right, right. All we do is go around and parasites on the rest of the world.
Parasite, the cancer of the, yeah.
Yeah. Now, if I turned around and said that about Jews, whoo.
Yeah. You'd be in jail in every country in the world except here.
Yeah, it's a good thing they got that free speech thing here. Our founding fathers were sharp cookies.
Yeah. Yeah, they thought basically. They didn't think the way we think, where you're trying to find some high meaning and trying to find some exception to it.
Well, but, yeah, I mean,
for example, racist. Why do you use weapons in war? Because it scares people.
Right.
As long as a grown man is afraid to ask somebody what a racist is, he can be accused of being racist, and he's afraid to ask what they are. I'm talking about Bill Riley, all those people who are supposed to be such brave types and all that. I've never heard one of them ask what a racist is.
Yeah.
So they found out it works. You know, they found out that we lift our little skirts and go,
oh, I'm not a racist. Some of my best friends are black.
I've been in politics. I look for that stuff. The minute I find that you're terrified of something, I'm going to drop it on you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to drop it until you begin to have some balls. And if you never get any conies, you know, then I'm just going to keep hitting you with it.
Yeah.
And you're going to find that unless you deal with it, you're never going to get your head up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I dealt with this with, like, black people. Because black people, really, that's not a natural line for them to pull out. But they've seen how whites recoil in horror from the
of course.
And so if you tick them off, they'll try to use it on you.
That's becoming a joke on the comic stuff, you know, like a Family Guy where they just racist.
Yeah.
Something they found a black horse and he was talking about, because I'm a black horse, you think I like chicken?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I saw a Saturday Night Live thing. This was quite a few years back, but it was they were making fun of one of those commentators on I think it was Hardball with Chris Matthews or something like that. And they had some guy dressed up as Chris Matthews, and then they have like the black guy, the black guest, and they have the white guest, and the white guest is like some gung-ho liberal, and he's just ranting like insanely on, and then Chris Matthews is acting all insane, and he finally cuts loose with, he's like, the poodle is the black man of the dog world.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like, the black guy's like, I don't know if that insults black people or poodles. I wanted to get a point on this, because back when, I'm recalling some of the conversations I had with a black guy that I worked with on race, very frank conversations, things that I wouldn't say to a black person today, but I was just young and kind of ticked off about racial issues and had some very frank conversations. And you know, I told him, I said, and this was before I come across Stormfront or anything. This is just me shooting my mouth off. I said, you know, white liberals are the most white supremacist people in the world. And I said, you know, we were talking about, you know, his life and my life, and I said, you could move to Denver into a large and white suburb, and because of your race, and this was a big, stout black guy, had been a bouncer and stuff like that, I said, you could go in there and you would be a novelty. You could play the token black in a circle of white liberals or whatever, and you could make your, you could hustle them. You could make your money just off of your skin color and who you are, because you're a novelty to them. Like they might buy a prize parrot or something like that.
Well, it's sort of, again, it's so basic. Hating yourself. You know, a lot of people for 2,000 years, we sort of, or 1,500 years, the greatest, the most moral person. Well, I'm getting off of what you're talking about because I heard you. I think your audience did too, but this won't work in a conversation now. For 1,500 years, we heard that if you really whipped yourself, you'd go to heaven if you starved yourself, whipped yourself, got no sleep. In other words, if you treated yourself the way that no human being should be treated by anybody.
Like wear a hair shirt until he went mad?
Yeah, yeah, those were bad, I tell you. But anyway, what I'm saying is this has been transferred to loyalty.
Right.
We used to be loyal to our country. Now, if you hate your country, you're sort of like a monk who didn't renounce himself. Now, the problem is, of course, Jesus said, the one law, and no, he said, made two, is do unto others as you would do unto yourself. Well, if a Trappist monk did unto others as he did unto himself,
he'd be a mean bastard.
Most of them wouldn't survive the first month.
Yeah. You know?
But they just turned it, and that's what essentially that. This goes back to our traditional values. That's why I keep trying to get rid of all these things of us trying to argue that that liberals are really discriminatory, or that
supremacist
stuff. I don't argue with what they're saying. What we're missing is some basic points. One is, it is sick to hate yourself.
It is.
And that is morality. You know, the more moral you are in our society, it used to be the more hair shirts you wore, and now it's the more you hate your own people.
Right.
But again, that only takes a sentence. That's the problem. We're not thinking about that. That's why it's so deeply into us.
Yeah.
That we have this sort of old need, which was sick in the first place. I mean, it certainly wasn't in the gospel. That we need to somehow torture ourselves, hate ourselves.
Right.
And that's sick.
It is.
And to hate your, and in our morality today, the highest thing is self-hatred.
It is.
If you're talking about, if you're a Methodist, you're talking about Methodists, you have to hate them.
Right.
If you're Irish, and you're talking about Irish, you have to say, well, you know, a lot of these stereotypes are true and so forth and so on, we're bad, and we had a lot of anti-Semitism, and so, you know, sort of like in the confessional. And a lot of it sounds like, you know, the sickest part of Calvinism, Catholicism, all of those religions had this.
Yeah. Yeah, and it
was opposite of the golden rule.
Right, right. Do unto others as you do unto yourself. And, you know, it like a little logic loop that it breaks is, I was talking to a good friend of mine a while back and talking about, you know, the imminent destruction of white folks. And he lives out in California, so he's seen it. And I said, it could be that someday we have to fight for our own interests and fight for our race. And, you know, that was just horrifying to him. And he said, well, you know, and I said, otherwise we're going to be destroyed. I mean, we're literally going to be killed or die. And he says, well, some things are worse than death.
Yeah, right.
And
exactly.
I said, look at the logic of that. I said, so if these others...
That's his morality.
Right. But I mean, just... Yeah, I mean, it's sick to start with, but, you know, if the logic is, well, you know, we can sacrifice the white race for these values. That was basically his point. There's things that are worth sacrificing for. Well, none of the other races really hold that same viewpoint. So if you're gone, then the world's going to become a much, much more savage place.
Well, see, now you're making it very complicated. Again, what I would do in that case is to say, once again, why don't you have a basic loyalty to your own? Don't these other races? In other words, I want to get beyond our saying. Actually, what I want to get beyond is our saying the other side is a bunch of hypocrites. That the other races or other peoples are a bunch of hypocrites. They're perfectly consistent, just like the people in the monasteries were. They're
right.
Just sick. And if you talk to them about, you know, self-destruction, I had a thought there with the, you know, you were talking about.
Well, the thing is the argument that they make is that the ideal is more important than the people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it doesn't matter if we're destroyed in the process as long as we're doing it for the right ideal.
Yeah.
And they're saying that, you know, the people that, you know, as long as we're helping out our Mexican neighbors or the Africans or whatever, the point out the hypocrisy, I mean, I think the reason you have to do that is because these people are thinking that they're doing something good for other people.
Yes, that's what I just said. And the conservatives believe the same thing. They're pro-life, and they say they want the third world to have all the children they can save, and it doesn't matter what color they are. And then they say, well, the borders don't matter. I remember seeing a cartoon one time that had Jesus with his cross walking across the Rio Grande, and these evil immigration officers stopping him. I mean, that's straight blasphemy, you know. But they conservative now, they're so desperate not to be called racist. You know, they are the ones who scream for the lynch mob. As soon as a liberal calls you a racist, he calls for the lynch mob of conservatives.
Oh, yeah. The respectable conservatives, as you put them, are much more deadlier to us than the liberals are because people actually trust them a little bit. But, you know, in the reality of communicating this stuff to people, to me, I think the best way to do it is just to turn it around. Like, for example, that example you just gave of the Mexican immigration and the cartoon of Jesus coming across with the cross, you know, everybody sees these people as victims coming into America to have a better life. But if you turn that around and say, all right, so what if I wanted to flood Mexico with Americans in order to, you know, make...
What if you were an illegal immigrant to Mexico?
Right.
What happens to you?
Well, you get shot or beat up, mugged.
Or what happens to you?
You get deported.
After what?
After being mugged.
No, after being in jail for a while, you broke the Mexican law.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't believe people can't think to see how hard it is to get across.
I admit it, Bob. My mind is weak.
It is illegal in Mexico for an American.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll be arrested. But beyond that, I mean, if I went to Mexico and said, well, okay, I want special laws to protect me and I want to have affirmative action so that Americans get the first shot at the best jobs, so on and so forth, you know, people would you know, because that would be, and also just if I wanted to flood Mexico with people from all over the world, to make an experiment to see if a blended humanity, what happens when you blend humanity together and in the process destroy Mexicans, you know, that would, everybody know that's genocide.
I don't know. There's just, the thing that's always worked for me is not to prove the other person is a hypocrite, but to talk about what he is saying. For example, what would a multicultural society look like? Brazil.
Right.
Next question.
Yeah.
You know, because I've heard liberals talk about this new race of ours, this new mixed race. Apparently they've never heard of Brazil.
Right. But, I mean, for the average person out there today, because that's what I try. See, that's one of the things is I know, Bob, a lot of your stuff is tailored towards, you know, it works great if you're talking about to a commentator who's dead set against you or in a tough audience.
Yeah.
But if you're just trying to talk to the average person out there, sometimes it's easier in some ways, but a lot of people don't know where Brazil is or what it looks like in Brazil.
Yeah. Well, that makes the intellectual there better act like he does.
Yeah.
The fellow I was talking about debate. See, that's what I've done. That's what my whole career was, debating with the other side.
Right.
And convincing people of things. That's why, you know, I've got a great pension.
Yeah.
I made my living on this stuff. But yeah, no, it depends on what you're doing. I'm just saying the thinking in the longer run, see, I have a particular front I'm fighting on.
Right.
That's why I turn down interviews or everything else, because nobody understands what I'm doing. It's not what they're doing. My little bugs group is thinking about what people already know and feeding it back to them.
Right.
Like I said, what happens if you go to Mexico?
You get arrested.
Go to jail.
Yeah.
Now, there was MSNBC had a headline that said, Arizona wants to make illegal immigration a crime.
Yeah.
There was no discussion of that. It just was such a wild idea.
Right.
That illegal immigration could be a crime. Well, if it's illegal, and if you want to check it out, just walk into Mexico.
See, that's a perfect example right there. Because, like, when you said that, that didn't register with me. They want to make illegal immigration a crime. Well, illegal means crime. But, you know, it just doesn't even register.
Right.
And because the assumption is that illegals have a right to be here. And that's been pounded so many times through so many avenues that people actually, they've been brainwashed, I guess.
The punishment is to go back to Mexico. Well, then why should we want people from a country where we consider an adequate punishment to be going back? I mean, what? Anyway, now I wrote a piece in my book, is what I wrote it for, Neurite Papers. I think it's in the libraries, but it was then. But I wrote about societal property rights, and I said, you know, the interesting thing about libertarians is that they believe in magic.
Yeah.
They believe that when you walk across the border, the American border, that somehow your labor is worth five times as much by magic.
Right.
But the reason that the American border is important is it is where American rule ends and rule by Mexicans begins.
Right.
That's all it is. And so it's the people in the country who make that border important.
Right.
Now, if you open up that border, then if you take the entire population of South America and stick it in the United States is going to live like like South America.
You know, you had an observation that you made that is so basic that I think we were talking about before we started the program here, that most intellectuals would just dismiss it out of hand, just the way the word illegal did not click in my head a minute ago. And that is that if you wake up not knowing where you are anywhere in the world and you look up and the people are brown, you know you're in a third world nation.
Yeah, right. And as Jesse Jackson said, that time, he said, I have to admit it, but if I'm walking down the street at night and I look around and the fellow behind me is white, I'm relieved.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's funny. You know, people crack jokes about it, but that the real world ramifications of the fact that if you live in a brown society, it's going to be a third world nation with all the things that come with that, crime and corruption and poverty. And we're letting the third world come into America. I mean, everybody knows that. See, this is the thing that really drives me insane, Bob, is because I know I don't get all these points right off the bat, but I get some of them like that.
Yeah.
And I could go somewhere like an Ivy League college, or I knew someone was going to Ivy League college, and I'd go up there and argue with people, and I know these people are smarter than I am. I know they're a hell of a lot smarter than I am. How can these basic facts escape them?
Well, they're not educated. That's the problem. You see, they don't think things through. They think in terms of authority. You know, if you show up, the reason you're going to be dumber than they are is because you're not from Harvard University.
Right.
I mean, they tell each other how, like Jane Fonda is always talking about the working class. When do you think was the last time she ever had lunch with a white working man?
Well, white working man might have been serving her lunch.
But you hear what I said.
Right.
They're always talking about the working class and all that stuff, but they want the intellectuals to rule the world.
Right.
Who are the intellectuals?
The professors.
In other words, the people who are doing the talking.
Right.
Now, what do you expect them to say? And that's what gets me, is liberalism is so obvious. Here a professor says that the military people shouldn't run the world, the capitalists shouldn't run the world, idealists should rule the world.
Right.
Intellectuals should rule the world. And every university campus is ruled by a philosophy that says idealists and intellectuals should rule the world.
Right.
And who are those universities made up of?
Intellectuals.
In their own terms.
Intellectuals.
Yeah.
So they're saying that we ought to rule the world.
To rule the world.
Yeah.
I wrote a book, my first book was about that 34 years ago, and I still can't get people to get that. Of course universities are left-wing. Left-wing says that they should rule the world.
Right. Yeah, if a person puts on their professor robe or their priest or their, you know, judge's robe, we automatically give them authority. You know, here's one. I was thinking about the other day, Bob. This just hit me a couple days ago. Because I'd heard you mentioning that point before about judges. And, you know, people despise lawyers. I mean, they hate them. When you come with polls, they say lawyers are the most untrustworthy, worthless people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But judges are lawyers.
Yeah.
Now, I actually didn't realize that until a few years ago. I really didn't. I thought that judges had their own track of being educated or something like that. But judges are lawyers.
Yeah. They're all, Earl Warren was the governor of California.
Right. That's a little disturbing. I mean, you think
he was
of a shyster lawyer.
He was a lawyer with political connections. That's all that a judge is.
And so, I mean, a shyster lawyer that you just despise, I mean, he's right there with the used car salesman, things like that. He puts on a robe, and all of a sudden, we're all humbled by him.
Actually, when he puts on the robe, he becomes the Constitution of the United States.
What? Why do you say that?
Because everybody says the Constitution is what the court says it is. The guys who wrote the thing are dead. I don't know if you noticed that. You know, I was even young when they died off. but the only constitution we have is our dominant, what is now our dominant branch. If you say that one branch is the Constitution, and the Constitution determines the distribution of powers, you have said that if a lawyer puts on a robe, he becomes the final authority in this country.
Right.
We've had a lot of fights about that. But I was just saying, I don't know, I'm not trying to trump you there. I'm just saying that it's such an incredible... I can't get people to think the way I do, because I think of jokes like, all right, if a man puts on a dress, he becomes the Constitution. Now, if he puts on high heels and mascara, does he then become the Bible?
Yeah.
And nobody can understand that joke because it's just, you know, in my mind, this thing is so ridiculous. But it takes a lot of thinking to get you to where you can look at this thing from that far away.
Yeah.
Judge so-and-so. You know, I'm talking about judge, you know, judge so-and-so here. Or associate justice so-and-so. To me, he's just a lawyer, you know, he's got a robo.
Right, right. Yeah, and I don't know, I've always thought that the Constitution doesn't really guarantee anything unless it's really, you know, people believe it in their hearts. Because, like, the, you know, they'll say, I remember there was a quote from George Bush that supposedly leaked out that when he was passing the Patriot Act and some of his advisors were saying it was unconstitutional, and supposedly George Bush said, well, the Constitution is just a piece of paper. Well,
yeah,
that's true. That's actually true.
Absolutely.
The Constitution is just a piece of paper unless, you know, people really know it, and most people haven't read it, but if they actually know it and believe it and are willing to die for it, then it means something. But otherwise, it's just a piece of paper.
Yeah, it is. It's whoever. That's the sort of thing that, you know, George Bush wanted power. But anyway, I'll tell you, the greatest constitutional crisis, or one of the greatest, what we would call constitutional crises we had, was when the Federalists won in 1798 and they passed Alien and Sedition Acts.
Right.
And nobody's even heard of them. But that was when the freedom of speech was saved. And it wasn't saved by the courts. The courts were powerless back then. It was the people that threw the Federalists out. The Federalist Party was destroyed by that.
Well, hey, one question there. There was a guy that died in a duel.
Madison.
And he was
Hamilton, yeah.
He was the head of the Federalists, right?
He was sort of the extreme. He was the philosopher.
Okay. What are the Federalists?
The Federalists were Washington, the party Washington identified with eventually, and he didn't believe there were any parties. He really believed there was just his party.
Okay.
And the Federalists, that was the first time Jefferson and John Adams, when Washington left office, Jefferson and Adams they contested the election, and they called the group that supported Adams, the Federalists.
Okay.
Adams, vice president. But the Federalists, yeah, they were Hamiltonian. They want a national bank. They want a stronger national government, high tariffs.
Okay.
Same thing Republicans came up with later.
Centralized power, though, basically.
Well, the working people, you know, the sort of Democratic types back in the 1801 when Aaron Burr killed Hamilton in that duel, they said, well, he couldn't have picked a better person to kill.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, you know, Burr was vice president.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But that was afterwards? That was afterwards, right?
What?
After the duel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't know he was going to kill him yet. They probably would have sent him bullets.
Yeah. You know what?
Your people, yeah. He said, Madison said, your people, sir, is a beast.
Right.
So, anyway, sorry, go ahead.
One of the things about our forefathers that I think that makes America different from Europe is that they thought the government was bad. And they basically they knew it would turn tyrannical at some point, so they kind of put in ways to hobble it along the way in the Constitution, balance of powers, and things like that. And
That's about half true. The Constitution, people have no idea what the Constitution is. They keep quoting the Declaration of Independence. Right? The only thing anybody knows is all men are created equal. That's it.
Right.
And that's in the Declaration. That was a propaganda thing we wrote in 1776 when we were in a state of war. It was
right.
Telling the world why they should support us. The Constitution is a contract.
Right.
A very careful contract. You won't find any declarations about mankind, equal or otherwise, in the Constitution.
Right. Well, now, we're running out of time here, and there's one thing related to what you just said that I want you to expouse on a little bit, which is these universal ideas, like, you know, this
wordism.
Thing for mankind, you know?
Yeah, wordism.
Right. And I think this relates back to what we were talking about earlier with communism, how, you know, where are you going to produce in communism? Well, a guy who wants to be a communist imagines that he's going to put a perfect society together, kind of like you were building a town with a model railroad, and it was going to be exactly perfect, and everything would work just perfectly. And that's kind of where I think this this wanting perfection, and that we can just have everybody, if we had the perfect dictator, he could make everybody do exactly what they were supposed to do. That's kind of where this wordism stuff goes, right?
I call that wordism because normally if you ask somebody who he is, I mean, in more sane times, one will say, well, I'm an American, and what are your morals? Well, I believe this works, this is good, this is bad, and so forth. Nowadays, if you ask somebody what they are, they'll say, do you mean am I a liberal or conservative? Which book do I go by? Am I sort of like the old religious? You know, am I a Presbyterian or Catholic?
Right. Or I'm a capitalist.
Well, that's just a means.
Yeah.
You're supposed to have a gut feeling.
Right.
Like I say, loyalty. Genocide is genocide. This is right. This is wrong. These things. Now, what your buddy told you about it's worth getting rid of the white race to impose his ideal, right?
Right.
His wordism. So
right.
He's got this book. It may be Marx. It may be Ayn Rand.
Or the Bible.
Or the Bible.
Like it's his interpreted.
His version. His
yep.
version. And, but they always say, well, that's universal. Actually, there are only a few nationalisms, but there are a billion religions.
Okay. So let me.
A billion universalisms.
Let me.
Nothing more divided.
Right. You know? So basically, what that means to me is like, I could be an American. If I live in America, if I look like an American, I can be British if I live in Britain and I look British, or I can be German if I look German, I live in Germany. But if I start wanting to divide myself up against other people along the lines of ideas, I mean, there could be a thousand different kinds of leftists that are all fighting to each other death to the death.
You could kill Russia and China damn near got into a war there.
Because they were both communists, but they weren't the exact same kind of communists.
Well, the Christians left their blood all over Europe.
Yeah, because
all over the Ottoman Empire, you know.
Right.
As soon as you get a book, as soon as you start arguing about a book, which is what intellectuals do, they're no holds barred.
Right.
I mean, you're not really a man anymore. You're like an ant.
Yeah.
I am a so-and-so.
Right.
Anyway, that's I'm still thinking about that one. You know, I'm still thinking about things I'm talking to you about. But basically, I just want to get people to get behind some of this crap and start. And like I said, you're in a great position because it took you over 2 years to get behind this, and that was fairly quick.
Well, I tell you, Bob, that wordism thing really hung me up. I kept hearing you say that wordism, or some of the people from your site talk about wordism, and I finally went on there a few months ago, and I typed in a question. I said, "What is wordism? I don't get it." And I said, "Is it where you make a religion out of an idea? Is that essentially it?"
Yeah.
And that's kind of my understanding of it now. But I mean, basically, to me, the alternative to wordism is easier to get my mind around. You know, where I don't know.
I think the alternative to wordism is being a human being.
Yeah.
Making your own choices, deciding you're not in a university, you're in the world. Whatever your choice you make is your choice.
Well, yeah, and your loyalties are not something I think that you can pick and choose. I mean,
right.
For example, I didn't choose to be an American. It's always funny to me when I talk to somebody who opposes my views, and they'll say, well, how can you be proud of your race? That's not something that you chose, that you earned, or anything like that. And to me, I say, well, it's my inheritance. You know, I don't have a choice. I can't just throw it away because our America, you know, I didn't choose to be born an American. I didn't choose to be, to inherit this land.
You didn't choose to be tall. You didn't choose to be short. You didn't choose any of those things. But a lot of your vanity is about how you look.
Right. Right.
I've seen people. I have a tendency to laugh in the worst places. I was in a salon one time picking my wife up. and some woman was getting some kind of God knows what kind of job done. And one of her lines was, well, looks don't matter. And I sat there, I started laughing, and she looked at me with this huge thing over her head and this puzzled look on her face. And I, you know, I didn't blame that. When they sit there and they say, looks don't matter, and they're paying $500, that's a lot. I mean, you know, but that's just too basic. Most people there wouldn't understand what I was laughing about.
Well, you know, I just look at it this way. You know, our forefathers, my forefathers, your forefathers came here, and they put in some long hours. They lost a lot of people along the way. They bled and fought and died for this place. And if I got my ass kicked, if America completely was overwhelmed by superior people who was better than us, I hate that. I'd fight to the death for it, but against it. But I'd understand that I was beaten by somebody better than myself.
Yeah.
But to throw it away.
Yeah.
Holy moly! You know, just
but that's self hatred. But I remind you, it is not new to our civilization.
I know it.
People were literally tearing their flesh off 1,000 years ago with that same kind of sickness. It's the same sickness again.
It is, but you know what, Bob? I got a lot of hope for the future. And the reason why is because when people bump up against reality, like we got a whole different generation growing up. The kids coming into adulthood today have an entirely different perspective than the kids in the 50s and 60s. Because the kids today are growing up, and even though their teachers may be pushing the same leftist crap, if they're getting beat up in the hallways or you know, I mean, at some point, it just doesn't work anymore.
Right. Well, I tell you, you're not unique, but the point is, it is very discouraging if you hadn't been like me and you've watched people like you pick up these ideas.
Yeah.
Because I know it takes forever, and I tell people, hit them with that mantra, and it's great to be outlawed. I mean, we're the only people who are actually banned. We can take some conservative thing, put the mantra on it. It'll last for about 2 days, and then the authorities will get to it, and it'll be taken off. That's classic revolutionary stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
If you see that happen in history, you think it's exciting. We're doing it, and we don't think it's exciting.
There's
people who saw it. Yeah.
There is starting to get to be some things that are pretty fun with it. Like, you know, you got this Tea Party thing going on, and Horace, who's a fan of yours, and he pushes the genocide issue. And somebody put up a sign at one of the Tea Party things that said white genocide, and it had no turn sideways in there to say no white genocide. And you know what? There's something really cool about being racial in public in a way that is completely defensive, not hateful, and saying, you know what, I have the moral ground here. I have the moral ground. And if you're going to be mad at me because I'm opposed to my genocide, I'm going to take the sign and just keep rubbing it in your face.
Right. Yeah, well, that's what revolutions, later on, the revolutionaries say, that those were the great days. You know, we were the only person carrying that banner.
Right.
And now, see, somebody like you, it might take you 2 years, but you're going to spread it, and some of the people are going to scratch their head, you know, in 4 years from now. I ain't in no rush, man. I've lived a long time, and I'll be dead a long time.
Yeah.
You know, but spreading, you know, seeding out this kind of thing, common sense back to Americans, is a great way to spend your life.
Well, yeah, that it is. It's fun. And, you know, that's one of the things that I try to put out there, too. A lot of people who have been involved with the struggle for a long time want to talk about how much they've suffered or this and that. But, man, I like ever since I've been involved with this politics, my life has gotten better every freaking day. Because, you know, here's the thing. This is the only thing I really truly believed in. Because it matters. I mean, whether we're around in 100 years matters.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what else am I going to have, you know? I'm going to be dead, babes.
Yeah. To the listeners, Bob, I appreciate you coming on.
Glad to be here.
Bob, your website is whitakeronline.org. Is that correct?
Whitakeronline.org/blog.
Okay. Whitakeronline.org/blog. And that's where you can find Bob's most recent writings. I check in there every couple days. I mean, there's always something that's thought-provoking there. And I appreciate you coming on, Bob.
All right, man.
Okay, and for the listeners out there, I'll see you guys next week, hopefully. Until then, walk tall, stay proud, and don't give them an inch.